Thanks very much for the introduction, and thanks to Michael and Mark for organizing this conference and for having me here. So this is joint work with my former student, Beowulf Kim. And in this paper, we are going to look at a new measure of systemic risk. We are going to estimate that measure from for the United States financial sector, and we are going to show that it actually does predict well the systemic risk in the U.S. Financial sector. Okay, I think we all agree on one thing, and that is that systemic risk is really difficult to measure. Okay, and that essentially makes it very hard for regulators and policymakers to address it effectively. And I want to single out here one major challenge, and that's to capture the risk spillovers that can occur in a increasingly complex and opaque financial network. And I want to single out maybe two sources of those spillover effects. And one is what I call information-based spillover. And the story here is as follows. The story is that systemic risk, or the risk of failure of financial institutions, that's driven by a set of risk factors. Those risk factors are common to several firms that might be correlated. And then it's rarely possible for us to perfectly observe all the risk factors that are relevant. Or if you do know what the relevant risk factors are, we might not be able to directly, you know, get data on those risk factors. Okay? So in other words, there's incomplete information about relevant risk factors. And because of that, we will, in a Bayesian way, update our conditional distributions about those risk factors at failure events in the financial system. Okay? So that in turn leads to discontinuities. Updating process leads to discontinuous changes in prices, and also to discontinuities in our assessments of risk. Okay? Then there's also contagion, and I guess it's pretty clear what I mean by that. We have this financial network, and the failure of one institution can sort of send dramatic ripple effects through the market and bring effectively down other institutions as well. Okay? And so bottom line is, you know, these are very worrisome features, and it's very difficult to actually incorporate them in a measure of systemic risk. So what are we going to do in this paper? As I said, we are going to propose a measure of systemic risk, and the distinction here, and I'm going to illustrate that, relative to the existing literature, is that we really do focus on failure of financial institutions. So we're looking at the default of financial institutions, and that's quite separate from what other people have done in this area, in particular as those papers have focused on, you know, significant large changes in the value of things, the value of financial institutions' assets, the value of equity of financial firms, or the, you know, prices for protection against default of those financial firms. Okay, so all obviously those things are all related, and they sort of contribute to systemic risk, but we believe that we should be more focused on the actual failure event, and we should be trying to predict that actual failure of financial institutions. Okay, so then we are going to develop a statistical methodology to estimate that measure from data on U.S. default timing, and we will take a particular emphasis on capturing the statistical implications of the risk spillovers in the form of contagion and in the form of information-based spillovers. Okay. And last but not least, I think it's also very important that we need to demonstrate in a rigorous study that the measure that we constructed, that we fitted, is actually accurately forecasting a systemic risk in the system that we're looking at. Okay, so that's the program, and the applications that we have in mind for this is really we'd like to have an easily estimated and tested measure of systemic risk that can be used to monitor the level of systemic risk in the market. Okay? In particular, we are going to show how to get a time series perspective out of this measure and a term structure perspective. Okay? So we can look at systemic risk in a term structure setting or on a time series, in a time series way. We are not at this stage able to use that measure to allocate aggregate systemic risk to individual financial institutions. That's still a work in progress, so I won't be able to talk about that, but that's definitely something that's very high up on our agenda. Okay, so at this point, we are just focusing on forecasting the level of systemic risk in the U.S. financial system. Okay, so here's our definition in blue of systemic risk, and I will demonstrate later on that it's quite distinct from what other people have proposed. So I'm going to be defining systemic risk as the probability of failure of a sufficiently large fraction of the total population of firms in the financial system. Okay, so what I have in mind here is really a significant default cluster, and that might be part of a larger economy-wide cluster of defaults. Okay, so what I have in mind here is really failure of financial institutions. Okay, I'm not going to be looking at prices getting depressed across the board. I'm not going to be looking at just credit spreads going up across the board. I'm interested in actual failure events. Okay, and that's important. So that risk, that systemic risk, is represented by the tail of the conditional distribution at some fixed time t of the default rate dt of cap t in the financial system during this time period. So the default rate is simply the number of financial firms defaulting in that interval here divided by the total population of firms at the beginning of the period. Of course, the obvious extension would be to look at a value-weighted default rate so that you would be including sort of information about the size on defaults. Okay, we haven't done that yet, but that's also something that's on the agenda. Okay?
To be clear,
yes, and yes, that's the way it is. Yeah. Okay, but it's the, you know, if you're trying to forecast the probability of a certain firm to go bankrupt, then you know you haven't observed that event to date, right? And you're trying to do the same thing, right? Yes. No, if you like, you know, at the level of this definition, it's not specific to any country, but it might be relevant for, you know, the estimation procedure that we are applying. I mean, it's obviously related to the amount of data that you have available, but we'll not done yet. Well, then it's going to be difficult to, you know, reliably estimate any measure of systemic failure. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That's why I'm saying, you know, the next step will be to look at the value-weighted default rate that takes into account the size of the defaulting entity. Right. We haven't done that yet, so that's a disclaimer. It will have a different effect than, say, you know, some savings bank defaulting. Yeah. That's definitely something that is not yet accounted for here in this setting. Okay. All right. So we have this distribution, and now we are interested in the tail of that distribution, and so there are various tail statistics that we could be looking at. We just picked the value at risk because it's a more or less familiar measure. So the value at risk would be tied to a specific confidence level, and it would be measuring the amount of mass in the tail of that distribution. There are many alternatives, convex alternatives such as expected shortfall, average value at risk, and the estimation that we're gonna show will permit us to actually calculate other risk measures as well. So we don't, you know, this whole thing is not tied to value at risk. Yes. I know. We know. Let me stop this discussion. I agree completely with you. That's why I'm saying, actually, what we're estimating is the full conditional distribution, and you can calculate whatever you want. The results that we have are formulated in terms of value at risk, but the methodology that we have captures whatever you desire. Okay. All right. So the point I wanted to make is that this thing depends on the conditioning time. So that gives you, by varying that conditioning time, you get a time series perspective. If you vary the horizon, you get a term structure perspective. Okay, so that's inherent in the definition of that particular risk measure. Okay, so here's the picture. Of course, we are all familiar with. This is an actually fitted distribution of the default rate at the end of our sample period, which is December 2008. And if you fix a certain level of confidence, I think it was here like, well, I don't know anymore what it was, like 1% or so, then obviously the probability of exceeding the value at risk would be actually equal to 1 minus alpha. So we know all of that by heart. All right. So let me maybe outline a few differences relative to the existing literature. There's a bunch of papers. Adrian and Brunemeyer and Sharia, Peterson, Philippon and Richardson, and a bunch of more papers that relate systemic risk to the distribution of the change in the market value, total market value of financial institutions. Okay, so they're looking at an event of equity values or market values of a bunch of institutions going down simultaneously. Okay, that's certainly a factor that sort of influences the level of systemic risk, but we believe it's not ultimately representing systemic risk. Okay, so our standpoint is that we should be looking at failure events and not just market values of assets getting depressed. Okay, there's a bunch of other papers that look at, as the previous one, at least partly look at systemic risk calculated under some risk-neutral probability. And as was explained in the previous talk, this incorporates then some measure of the risk premium that investors demand for bearing exposure to correlated failure. Okay, so we are estimating our measure under statistical empirical probability, and that means it's not incorporating any of those risk premium components. Okay, so that's a matter of perspective. We believe, you know, if the regulator is a risk manager, then the regulator should be looking at the risk actual distribution, and risk premia shouldn't be going into that systemic risk assessment. Okay, so the third bullet point is that our measure is estimated from actual default experience. So we're going to be looking at actual historical default experience in the market of interest, actually in the wider economy of interest. That's data that none of the previous studies has ever used, and we believe it's very significant to use that data, because ultimately, again, we are interested in failure. Okay? We're also going to be including a set of time-varying explanatory covariates, including market values that have been used in the context of these and those studies. So it's not that we're just backward-looking. No, we also have market variables that we take into account when we forecast the distribution of the failure rate. Okay? But I'll make that precise in the next couple of slides. So our statistical methodology is built around a two-step maximum likelihood procedure. So we start off with a dynamic hazard or intensity model of economy-wide default timing. Okay. Before looking at the financial system, we look at the larger economy. Okay, and we view the financial failures as part of a sequence of failures in the larger economy. Okay, and our intention is to capture statistical implications that industrial defaults have for financial defaults. Okay? We don't want to just look at financial defaults in isolation. We want to be looking at those events in the context of what's going on in the larger economy. It doesn't require it, but that's the way we set this up. Okay, it doesn't require it, but that's the way we set it up. Okay, so it will also be the other way around. But you will see it when I make it precise. Okay, so there's then this the second part to it, which is also a dynamic hazard model, but that's then representing the default timing or the probabilistic structure of default timing in the financial system. Okay, and just to outline two advantages of that two-step procedure. One is that we are going to be able to capture the statistical implications, the emphasis on statistical, of industrial defaults for financial failures, and actually also vice versa, but I don't want to emphasize that point here. We also get a higher predictive power of our system-wide estimators. We tested a one-step, tested this against a one-step procedure, and the estimates that we're getting out of this two-step procedure clearly had higher predictive power. Okay, that was one reason why we settled on that. Okay, so let's start out with the economy-wide default timing, and then let's see how we can specialize into the system-wide behavior. Okay, so we start out with a hazard rate or intensity model, and we call it lambda star, and you can think of this as the conditional mean arrival rate of defaults in the whole economy. Okay, and that is a quantity that's measured in events per year. We then start with a concrete econometric model for this for the time evolution of that hazard rate or intensity in general. That's going to be a stochastic process, and that process is influenced by a set of explanatory covariates X star, and those represent the influence on systemic risk, or on, I should be careful, on economy-wide default timing of explanatory covariates. Okay. And we also have a second term here that's supposed to represent the influence of past arrival times on the current default rate. Okay. And the way it works is that whenever there's an event, the hazard rate is going to jump. The impact of the event is decaying over time in an exponential way, and the decay rate is specified by a parameter kappa. And the size of the jump at an event is effectively linear in the log of the size of the defaulter, and the size is measured in terms of the debt of the defaulter outstanding at default. Okay, that's one particular measure of size. We've tried other measures but found that this one really did work best. Okay, so in the end we have a parameter vector of four components. This guy here is another vector that specifies the influence of a covariate on the intensity. Then we have the decay parameter, and we have two parameters related to the size of the jump in the hazard rate at an event. Okay, and let me just show you one simulated path of the intensity and this impact process J. So you can imagine that in the absence of an event, the failure rate is just fluctuating around according to the movement of those covariates, right? And whenever there's an event, like at this point here, the rate jumps up, and the size of the jump is a linear function of the log of the debt outstanding at default. Okay, and then it continues on. You have an exponential, on average, decay with random fluctuations around that. So the two terms have names. The first term is the baseline hazard, and that one takes the standard proportional hazards form. And as I said, it models the influence on default timing of explanatory covariates. And that's been, you know, that's that specific formulation that's been very heavily used for decades to predict industrial defaults and also to predict bank failures. Okay? We extended that model by including this spillover hazard term, which is not present in this traditional formulation. And the intention is here to capture the statistical implications of risk spillovers. Right? And now let me be precise what I mean by that. So we said we have two types of, or two sources of risk spillovers. One is contagion, and the idea here is fairly clear, right? So at an event, the rate of further events is going to jump up, and the size of the impact is related to the size of the defaulter, right? That makes sense. But this term also captures in a reduced form way the Bayesian learning that occurs at events about unobserved risk factors, okay? And one can make this more formal, but the idea is that, you know, if you wanted to formulate God's model, you know, God has perfect information, lives in a very fine filtration, right? Okay. And so we as the mortals, we live in a small filtration, okay? So we have to project the complete information onto a small filtration. So we have to address a filtering problem. If we do that, we're going to see that the filter, right, evolves deterministically between events because there's no information coming about events between events, but jumps at event times. And those jumps are precisely the ones that we have modeled here with this term. So this term sort of soaks up any movement in the default rate that's not coming from the explanatory covariates. Okay? So that's the idea here, and the likelihood estimation is a fairly standard business here. We can write out the likelihood or the log likelihood function in this form here. So the intensity process shows up at its left limit here, and n is just the counting process that keeps track of all the events that occur in the economy. Okay? So this can be written out given a trajectory of the covariates, right, which we do observe over a sample period. You stick this back into this model, right? So this is the model. You stick the covariates in there because you observe them. You also do observe the event times that cause the jumps here and the associated jump sizes. So the intensity is deterministic given the covariates and given the jump times and jump sizes. And so that makes up the likelihood function that we are going to maximize with respect to the parameter vector. Okay. So this is a fairly standard thing. It's computationally pretty tractable. So there's not really a black box that's doing this, but it's a well-formulated and numerically stable problem to address. Okay. Now let me show you some results. So a sample period is the beginning of 87 till the end of 08. As I said multiple times, we have data on actual default timing and default volumes, the debt outstanding at each of those events. And we're getting that from Moody's Default Risk Service database. We've also looked at a larger set of explanatory covariates. So we explored a very big set. And those are the variables that we, in the end, used. Those are the ones that we found significant in one of the two parts of this estimation procedure. And I'll explain that. Okay, so most of those variables are pretty standard. We have the S&P 500 index return. We have the lagged slope of the yield curve. We have the default spread. We have the TED spread. We have trading returns on banking and fire portfolios. Banking portfolios, clear fire is finance, insurance, and real estate. So these are portfolios defined by Moody's. And we are just looking at the trading one-year returns of those portfolios. And last but not least, kind of a non-standard covariate is the default ratio, which is relating the number of failures in the financial system over some time window, where there's a parameter H that we're going to set, to 1 plus the number of economy-wide defaults during that period. So that is sort of a keeping track on a rolling basis of past default activity. We use the current one. All right, so here are the estimation results. Of all of those covariates, and that initially it was a bigger set of covariates, only three of those variables were found to be significant. So we have a constant, we have the S&P 500, we have the slope of the yield curve, and we have the default spread. So these are the variables that remain to be significant as for the baseline hazard part. And of course, we have the spillover hazard term, and all the parameters here turn out to be significant. So what does it mean? What do those parameters mean? Well, they mean that at an event in the economy, the intensity is going to jump, okay? And the jump, if you measure it in events per unit of time per year, is estimated to be roughly 2.3 times one half of the log of the default volume as measured in $1 million. Okay, so it gives you some idea of how large the jump is in the default rate at an event. Okay, and the fitted half-life of an event, remember that the impact of an event decays exponentially, and the fitted half-life is roughly 0.11 years. That's what these parameters over here related to the spillover hazard tell you. So if you go back, that's the way it looks like, right? So you have the kappa parameter over here, you have a gamma and delta parameter here, and these relate to the behavior of this thing. And what remains is the beta for the covariates that are significant, and that's this part over here. So we just performed a couple more tests, a base factor type test, where we said, well, how significant is the spillover hazard term? And so we looked at the so-called base factor, which is just slightly different from a likelihood ratio type test statistic. So you're looking at the likelihood of a complete model or of a benchmark model divided by the likelihood of some alternative model, okay, and multiply that by two, and that's known as the base factor, and it gives you some measure of you know, the significance of a model component. Okay, if you do that, so you test a model, a complete model, against one that does not have this spillover hazard term, you're getting a base factor of 213, which is extremely strong evidence in favor of including such a term. Vice versa, if you're testing a model that, a complete model against one that does not have a baseline hazard term, so no covariates, you're getting a base factor of roughly 26. It's still providing very strong evidence of including that type of component. Okay, that's just diagnostic stuff. Eventually, we want to test this more rigorously in an out-of-sample. Yes? Yeah, it doesn't, you know, it seems that it can be. I mean, it's, you know, that's the weakest of the three in that sense. So that's the way it came out. Yeah. Well, in any case, that is the fitted intensity here against the number of defaults in a given year. So the circle here would represent the number of actual realized events in that particular year here, and the red line is representing the fitted intensity. Okay, so we see that this seems to be matching the actual arrivals pretty well. And now we'd like to test this more formally. Okay, how good is the in-sample fit? And the way we're going to do this is we are recalling a fundamental result due to Meyer, which says that if you have a counting process, okay, then you can time change the counting process back into a standard Poisson process using a change of time that's given by the compensator to the counting process, which is the integrated intensity. Okay, and now this gives you a recipe for actually testing the in-sample fit of a given timing model. Okay, so our counting process here is just counting events in the economy. Okay, and we fitted the arrival rate or intensity of that counting process, so we can integrate it up, okay, get the fitted compensator, and we can test whether the rescaled arrival times are actually Poisson arrival times. Okay, and if so, well, then our model is correctly specified. So there are various tests of the Poisson. Well, let me show you a graph of that. Right. So what I just described, we have our arrival times here. Those are the actual observed default times in the economy, okay? Now we have the fitted intensity integrated up, shown as a blue line, and then we simply rescale each of those arrival times at the cumulative fitted intensity to get a new sequence of arrival times. And if our fitted model is specified correctly, this thing here should form a Poisson process, a standard Poisson process, and that's what we're going to test, right? So one thing you could do is you could test off, test that these inter-arrival times here are standard exponentials independent, right? Another test would be to just chop up the time, the transformed time, into intervals of size C, okay, and then test whether the realized number of events in each of those bin sizes is the realization of a Poisson variable with mean C, okay? So that's what we're going to do, and then we can apply various tests, including Fisher's dispersion test, an upper tail test, which is testing for, you know, the dependence in the tail, and a serial dependence test to see whether our Poisson hypothesis can be rejected, and it cannot be rejected for a variety of different bin sizes. Okay, so that's indicating more formally that the model that we formulated for the default activity in the anti-economy is actually doing pretty well in sample. And later on, we're going to test the result of our systemic risk measure out of sample on top of that. Okay, so that's giving us a fairly accurate representation of default timing in the anti-economy. And the next step is going to be getting from there to the failures in the system. Aaron.
I want to make sure I understand how you're thinking. Let's say you get a call in January, and then the rate you're going to test it.
Yeah.
So when you go to tell them you did a good job predicting over that year, you're going to have some number of defaults, but your intensity parameter will come up because of the default. So you might be.
No. There's only one set of parameters, right? If you go back to the formulation here, right? So this is a process, it varies around, okay? And it has a number of fixed parameters. And those are, you know, the beta, it's linking the covariates that vary to the intensity, and that's the kappa here, that's the gamma and the delta, okay? So we take the full beta in one shot and find that set of parameters that's, you know, maximizing the likelihood of the observations. It is fair, but it's an in-sample test. It's fair, but it's an in-sample test. We are just more formally testing whether this red line really is fitting well the actual number of the. Well, you don't set it, right? It's the likelihood estimation is fitting it through somehow. Yeah. Well, it's not by the end of the year, because here you're looking at it as a continuous time process. It's not a per year type analysis. You're really looking at it in a continuous time fashion. Yeah, well, that is just per year, because I cannot, right? This is the summary statistics, but that's why I was saying, I mean, this gives you only a very rough picture of whether, you know, you're getting a decent fit. The, you know, more rigorous procedure would be doing the statistical test that I just described. Okay. All right. Yeah, it's real data. But it's, you know, it's zoomed, but it's zoomed in. This is zoomed in here, obviously, right? It's zoomed in. This is like just the first six event times out of like 1,500. Yeah. No, not on the larger time scale. No. Yeah. All right, anyway, so now the more interesting part is now how do we go down from the economy to the system, right? And the observation is pretty simple, right? So we look at the sequence of all events in economy. Now, the failures in the financial system, Well, they form a subsequence of the sequence keeping track of everything that's happening, right? Okay. Now, that's the first observation. So the second observation is, because this is so, let me maybe write this down here, okay? So we have a, let's call this T star N, a sequence of event times in the economy. We have a counting process associated with that, okay? And we have an intensity. And we've just fitted that intensity, right? That was a red curve. But now we also have the financial failures. That's also a sequence, okay? But it's a subsequence of that one, right? And so the counting process here, N, can be constructed from that one. We're just dropping some of the jump times of this thing to get the jump times of that thing, okay? So this thing also has an intensity. Now the question is only, you know, what is that intensity, and can we link the two, okay? And we can link the two, and mathematically it's summarized in this little proposition here, and it just says that, okay, if you look at the compensator through this counting process, which is just the integral of this, okay, and you look at the compensator of that thing, which is just the integral of that, then there are two random measures associated with the two compensator, and they are absolutely continuous. Okay, and then the Radon-Nikodym theorem tells you, well, there must be a density process saying that, you know, that's called Z, that's all notation, and that's equal to the lambda to the lambda star. So that follows directly from the Radon-Nikodym theorem. Okay, so there's a pretty straightforward way now, mathematically, to go from the top level to a sub level, and that allows us to go from the estimated lambda star to the intensity of the financial failures, which is ultimately what we're interested in. Okay? And now we can think of, and it can be made more precise, but we won't do this here, the value here, the ZT, that's linking, it's a stochastic process itself, that's linking the intensity of the financial failures to the intensity of the failures in the anti-economy. The value of that process at time t can be thought of as the conditional probability at t that a firm in the financial system defaults next, given the default in the economy in the next instant. So it's sort of a local thing. It's a local probability, right? So just intuitively, okay? And now what we're going to do is we can estimate that Z process here. And, you know, we tinkered around with different formulations but ended up using a probability regression where we say, well, the probability, you know, conditional probability that a firm defaults next, a financial firm defaults next, given an event in the economy at the next instant, that's going to be some function of a bunch of covariates. And the link function is the normal CDF, or the probability model, right? And there's a bunch of coefficients that we're going to estimate. Okay. Well, that's the next step, and probability regression is, of course, simple, right? So the data for this is, what's the data for this? The data is, for each event, we know whether it's an industrial versus a financial. So we have a sequence of indicators, just 0, 1, 0, 1, right? 1 if it's a financial, 1, 0 if not, okay? So this is the input data to the probability regression, and we link this now to a bunch of covariates, X. Okay, and the covariates that we find significant are those ones here, the constant, it's again the slope of the yield curve, it's a TET spread, it's a return on the banking portfolio, return on the real estate portfolio, not the entire FIRE portfolio, but just the part related to the real estate, and the default ratio. Okay, and again, you can do these base factor tests and see that those coefficients are actually meaningful. Yes?
A higher return on the banking sector increases.
Yeah. It doesn't, but of course, as we know, right, if you have a multivariate covariate vector, you can't really conclude that a good year in the banking sector would imply a higher level of systemic, or, you know, a higher risk of failures in the financial system. By univariate reasoning, I would agree with you. Then I would be suspicious. But because you're looking at a vector anyway, then you can't really tell, right? Okay. But that's the only you pick the right thing, right? that's the only coefficient that's kind of an unexpected sign. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, so that's the Z process now that we fitted, right? So here we have the indicators, right? It's zero most of the time because most of the defaults are actually non-financial industry defaults, and there's a bunch of events that are actually financial defaults, right? So that's the Z process here. Now we have the Z process, and it, you know, towards the end of the sample, towards the beginning of 09, that goes up, and that's going to be something we see in our estimators. Okay, so that's just an intermediate step here. In order to test this again, what we did is we constructed a power curve. So we looked at the ability of that Z process to distinguish financial defaults from industrial defaults. Okay, so we looked at the fraction of the true positives correctly forecast financial default versus false alarm. The uninformative model, the random model, where you just flip a coin, has a power curve equal to this diagonal, whereas a perfect model would have a power curve that's going straight up here and like that, right? It would identify all or almost all of the actual financial defaults from the non-financial defaults while making no false alarms. Okay, so of course the actual model is somewhere in between, and the performance of the model is not great in this respect, but it's reasonable. Okay, it's reasonable. Anyway, it's only intermediate, and here is the fitted system-wide failure intensity. It's just the product, again, of the fitted lambda star, that was the first part, and the fitted Z, which was the second part. Okay, and this is how it looks. And the interpretation is this. This is the probability at each point in time to have a failure in the financial system, right? And that fluctuates around at relatively low levels, but except, you know, towards the end of the sample, end of 08, this is shooting up here. You know, indicating that there is a much higher, also in historical perspective, much higher likelihood of financial failures. But again, this is only an intermediate quantity. Before we go to this one, let's take a look at that one. That's just an illustration where we look at the fraction of that red intensity I just showed that's tied to the spillover hazard term to the total failure intensity. Okay, just one thing. Let me just explain that one thing, right? And what you see is that, okay, that fraction that's tied to the spillover hazard is relatively high for most parts of the sample. So a lot of the action is actually explained by that additional spillover term. Or turned around, if you're using the usual suspect covariates, you cannot really explain well the variation in systemic risk. Okay, you need to include some additional terms that would represent imperfectly observed covariates, and it would represent, you know, contagion. Okay. Here we have just, you know, indicated that the crosses are financial defaults versus the blue dots are just industry defaults. So you see, if the fraction of the total failure intensity is tied to the hazard, the fraction of the total failure intensity tied to the hazard, to the spillover hazard is high, then we most likely have financial defaults. Okay, that's what this says. And going now to a perhaps more informative picture, you were looking at the time series of the fitted conditional distribution of the system-wide default rate for a 6-month horizon. Okay. So here, this is the sample period, right? This is this dimension here, and this is the default rate in percent, 1%, 2%, 3%, and so on, of the financial system. So that would mean, you know, if the realization was here, that would mean that 3% of the total number of institutions in the financial, in the U.S. financial system would default within 6 months, okay? And it's not, you know, that was estimated at this point. And so now we move on, and we propagate forward that distribution. So what I want to say is that there's a very significant bump here, so that the risk of the systemic risk obviously went up by quite a bit towards the end of the sample period, quite expectedly. But what I wanted to point out is that if you compare that with the same kind of distribution for the entire economy, then of course you also see that the risk of industry defaults went up as well, right? But if you now compare this with what happened during the internet bubble, you know, there's a significant bump here as well that's not really present in the case of the system-wide default rate, and that just indicates that this time is different in a way, right? Well, this time was different. I mean, in terms of the entire economy, yeah, we had the internet bubble and we have, you know, we have the defaults, more recent defaults, right? Both kind of bumps here, but on the systemic level, this is kind of different because we don't have a bump really during the internet bubble. The internet bubble was more contained to the real economy. It wasn't so much an issue of systemic risk. But this time, you know, towards the end of 08, systemic risk was much more prevalent as a fraction of total default risk in the economy than it was. That's no, that's auto sample. Well, yeah. That's before. That's always estimated auto sample, right? So you have only data if you pick one date here, right? You have only data observed up until this date. So you estimate the model, do the forecast. It's like the last, you know, it's the last quarter. That's a quarterly. These are quarterly. So that's the last quarter of 08, where it occurs. But we'll see it more clearly. I mean, this is just illustration, but we see more clearly how the value at risk is behaving over, you know, over time. Then it's more clear what's happening. Well, it's the end. Yes, a few days after. Okay. Well, that's just the another possible risk measure that you could be looking at if you're saying I don't like value at risk. I don't like setting the confidence level because I don't know what to pick. Well, you could look just at a risk measure that is the probability of no failures at all in the financial system. Okay. And here would be the time series of that, fitted time series of that for various risk horizons. Here that would be just a quarter, that would be 6 months, that would be 1 year, right? The blue one would be 1 year. Of course, it has to go down because defaults only accumulate over time. So that would be some alternative measure you could be looking at if you like so. Okay, now going back to what Rama said, here we see more clearly what systemic risk or how systemic risk behaves over the sample period. So we're looking at our risk measure. That's the value at risk, the fitted values of that value at risk for a 6 month period for two different levels of confidence, the 95% and the 99. Right? That's the 95, and the upper one is the 99, obviously. Okay? And the red dots here are just the realized default rates. Okay? Of course, we would expect that the value at risk is sort of you know, sitting above in both cases of the realized default rate, which it does. And we can later on formally test how good the value at risk was predicted versus the realized default rate. Yes? Say that? Yeah. Yeah, because this is all out of sample, right? We have to have a couple of years worth of data to estimate our distribution and then forecast. I mean, if you. No, yeah, because defaults are rare events. So if you have only like 5 years or so, and you have only three events or something like that, then obviously your maximum likelihood isn't very accurate. So you need a couple of numbers of years. Yeah. Okay. So the next step then, we want to test how accurate that measure is actually relative to the realized number of events. So this is the first 6 months of 2009, Okay, so the forecast was then made with data available up to the end of 08, and then forecast for the next 5 years. Okay, and that would be default rate for the first 6 months in 09, realized. Okay, you have term structure perspective, right, for different confidence levels. You know, I'm not emphasizing this here. If this is the forecast horizon, this is the value at risk, then you get a term structure perspective of this as well. So we haven't explored that any further, but that's something that's there anyway and can be used if necessary. Okay, so now time's running up. So let me just quickly talk about predictive performance before wrapping up. As I said, we'd like to compare the fit evaluate risk to realized default rate. Now, the way it works is that we have just repeated experiments, right? So it's like for each forecast period, we have a forecast and we have a realization, okay? Now we can just look at whether the forecast held true, or in other words, whether the realized rate violated the value risk, okay? So we get a sequence of hit indicators. Most of the time, there should be zero, but for a couple of times, there should be one, okay? And now we can test more formally how predictive our forecast is, right? So these hit indicators, if the model really were correct, if the forecast were correct, then these hit indicators should follow a sequence of IID by million variables with the correct success probability given by 1 minus the confidence level. So you would expect some violations of the value risk, but in the right proportion, okay? So if you have 100 forecast periods and level of 1%, then we would expect to see at least one violation and 99 non-violations. That would be good, then would be good, right? If you have no violations, it's like your value risk is always too high. You don't want to put it too high. Okay, and now we can test this using various tests that come from the literature on the value risk, right? So that's not something that we invented here. There's an unconditional coverage test, which just simply says, okay, what's the theoretical violation ratio, which is this one, against the realized one? Is there a significant difference, yes or no? That's the unconditional coverage test. And then we have two more comprehensive tests of the IID Bernoulli property of that sequence here, okay? And all of those tests cannot be rejected for various time horizons and for two distinct confidence levels with very high p-values. Okay, so each of those individual tests that we run for the different forecast horizons and confidence levels cannot be rejected. So that means, you know, statistically, the measure that we've constructed that we fitted does seem to perform quite well according to those tests, okay? One has to say, one has to admit, of course, that for a forecast period of 1 year or 6 months, we don't have that many observations, okay? So, you know, we have to take this with a grain of salt. But, you know, if you're going to 1 month period, then you're getting quite decent forecasts already, okay? So then you're getting to a number of one, okay, it's above 100 is not huge, but it's at least not not small. And I also should say that especially one of the tests, the caveat test of Enge and Manganelli, was shown to have very good power even for very small sample sizes. Okay, so that gives us some motivation for including that test as well. Okay, so let me conclude. We proposed a measure of systemic risk that was designed to quantify risk of actual failure clusters in the financial industry. It does complement existing measures that focus more on, you know, a simultaneous change in market values across financial institutions or simultaneous changes in credit spreads across financial institutions. Our measure gave us a time series and a term structure perspective on systemic risk. We've developed a two-step maximum likelihood approach to estimating this measure that was based on actual default experience and a bunch of time-varying explanatory covariates. We've tried to account for the statistical implications of risk spillovers through the inclusion of this spillover hazard term, and we've shown that this term actually was important in capturing the action. And we've also shown, or at least indicated, that our measure accurately predicts the level of systemic risk in the U.S. financial system. And with that, I'd like to end.